This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Monkeypox is now called Mpox and is nothing new. Human cases were first reported in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 1970, but a new variant, which also originated in the DRC, is worrying scientists because of the speed with which it spreads. Cases have also been reported as far apart as Thailand and Sweden. The World Health Organization have put this virus on its priority pathogens list, i.e. something that could cause a pandemic. Does that mean we should be really worried about it? And if so, how prepared are we to tackle it? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, the basics. What is Mpox and how does it spread? Dr. Jonas Albanaz is a research fellow specialising in pox viruses at the Purbright Institute. Jonas Albanaz, if I were to look at the organism that causes Mpox in a microscope, what would I see?
Mpox is a virus and therefore is quite small. I think a good way to try to visualize it is comparing with the virus that causes COVID, SARS-CoV-2. In comparison with SARS-CoV-2, Mpox is much more complex, so it's a bigger virus and around 3 times bigger. So we are talking 100 nanometers for SARS-CoV-2, around 300 nanometers in diameter for Mpox, and it has a lot more proteins. So it has around 80 proteins, which is 20 times the number of proteins that SARS-CoV-2 contains.
Mpox is no longer called monkeypox. It started off being called that. Why is it no longer called monkeypox?
Because it was a misnomer to start with. The virus was discovered in the 1970s. It was discovered in Denmark in a monkey in a zoo. The virus was recognized to be a member of the pox virus family. Therefore, it was called monkeypox because it was detected in a monkey. Later that year, the first human case was detected in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Monkeys are as an accidental host as a human. So it circulates in the wild in Central Africa and West Africa in small mammals, some rodents. We don't know exactly what species are the animal hosts of this virus in the wild, but it's definitely not a monkey virus per se.
Where does it come from geographically and how common is it?
Well, Mpox, since the discovery in the 70s, it is found in small mammals in forests in the West and Central Africa. A person would acquire the virus from an infected animal via hunting or like eating bush meat, and then would become sick and transmit the disease for a few close contacts in households. But usually these outbreaks would happen in quite remote villages, and they would go through like 2 or 3 cycles of transmission and would die out. Over the years, this has been the most common scenario. And one particular quite remarkable outbreak that happened outside Africa was in 2003 when imported prairie dogs in the United States acquired the disease from imported rodents from Africa. These pet prairie dogs transmitted the virus to their pet owners, and there was an outbreak with dozens of cases in the United States. But again, it was zoonotic. They had this link to a wild animal in Africa.
Zoonotic, there's an animal infected that somehow infects a human being, eating, etc. The human being can pass it on to other human beings, but usually only under circumstances of close contact.
Yes.
And then usually that outbreak dies down. We're used to the notion, or become used to the notion, of airborne transmission, either through droplets or through kind of particles and so on. What happens on skin-to-skin transmission?
So this virus, it causes a skin infection, and therefore it will cause these lesions in the skin that will become filled with fluid secretion that is full of viruses. And these blisters, they will be the main source of the virus that via close contact.
Are there any other ways, apart from skin-to-skin contact, that this virus can be spread?
Is skin-to-skin contact, is close contact, including hugging, kissing, and sex, but also contact with objects that had been manipulated by an infected individual, that like towels or other objects that have come in contact with these lesions, these blisters.
So the virus essentially sits within these blisters and
yes,
these pustules
yes,
and so
yeah.
on. Apart from raising these blisters, how else does it affect the human body?
The virus will enter our body, will then start to replicate. And to start with, in the first few days, we will experience like flu-like symptoms, which are like headache, fever, swollen glands, muscle ache. So quite like non-specific symptoms that then will develop to the appearance of lesions in the site of infection where the contact happened. The virus can also reach the bloodstream, and therefore it will disseminate throughout the body and then will cause this presentation that we have seen recently in the news, which is these lesions, these blisters covering the entire body. In which case, the clinical presentation of this disease resembles smallpox, in which the entire body is covered in blisters and will also affect internal organs, and that will then possibly lead to death.
Jonas Albanaz, and just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including our two recent three-part mini-series on the future of health and on global tensions. Back to Mpox, and now I want to understand a bit more about this latest strain, how worried we should be about it and how prepared we are to deal with it. Joining me to discuss that are Dr. Lilith Whittles, lecturer and postdoctoral fellow at the MRC Centre for Global Infectious Disease Analysis, Dr. Josie Golding, head of epidemiology at the Wellcome Trust, and Trudy Lang, professor of global health research at the University of Oxford. Trudy Lang, when I was reading up about the latest Mpox outbreak, I came across the phrases strain, variant, and clade. Can you explain the difference to me?
Yes, I knew we'd get straight into the description of what a clade is. So there's several terms that are being used interchangeably. So the most common term people use is a strain of different viruses, but the virologists hate that, and it's a very sort of clunky term that describes all things. We probably all remember from COVID the discussions about a variant of concern, and that's a more accurate term when we see when a virus mutates and becomes something different. With a clade, it's quite a precise genetic term, which talks about just when we have a new branch of the tree appear and it's very distinct, then we term that a new clade.
Right. And the new clade is clade 1B. Josie, how does that differ from clade 1A?
The difference between clade 1A and 1B really at the moment, with the knowledge that we have, relates to the populations that we're seeing circulate and where it's been transmitted from. So clade 1A has been around on the African continent now for decades. It's known as a kind of a zoonotic virus coming from animals into people and being sustained, you know, through that kind of close contact. While clade 1B is something novel, something new that we've just really only come across in the last few months, and the behavior of transmission seems to be from person to person. Sexual transmission seems to be one of the routes of transmission and close contact. So again, it's those at-risk populations that we're seeing. Now, this is early days. particularly for 1B. So this could evolve and could change. Once we start really investigating, we might get more information between the differences between the two different clades.
And when and where did we start seeing cases of this new clade 1B? Trudy Lang.
The first observation of what is now called clade 1B was in September last year in a town called Kamatuga in South Kivu in DRC. Up till then, we'd known around clade 1, now we're now calling clade 1A, circulating across that same region in Africa, but not in this region. And so what we're seeing at the moment is two quite different types of Mpox circulating in different places and presenting quite differently. And that's why it was made a public health emergency of concern by WHO.
Lilith Whittles, how many cases of clade 1B are we seeing?
In DRC, up to the 23rd of August this year, there have been almost 20,000 suspected cases recorded. However, there's not a huge amount of availability for confirmatory testing, so only a small proportion of those have actually been confirmed to be Mpox. When we talk about case reporting, that's not only a function of the number of infections that we see, but also the reporting systems that are different in different countries.
Trudy, can you explain a bit more about how clade 1A and clade 1B differ in terms of how easy it is to get them in terms of transmissibility?
What's typical with clade 1A is where a family have brought some infected meat into the household, usually to eat, and that infected meat, and it could be something like a squirrel or a rat or a monkey. We've also seen cases with pigs being infected. The family have brought that meat into the household to consume, and then the infection that has followed has been limited to that household. What's different now, and this is beginning to be reported, is that we're seeing this, what we know to be clade 1B. The report so far, and the data is being analysed as we speak, none of the cases have reported this being acquired through meat whatsoever. It's all been person to person and household and community transmission. And so that's quite an important distinction that we are at the moment beginning to see. And this is some of the important unknowns, which is why it was made an emergency.
If zoonotic is the word for transmission from animals to humans, is there a word for human-to-human transmission?
Yeah, we just call this person-to-person transmission, which then can be subdivided. We're concerned here, we're seeing a lot of sexual transmission at the beginning, but this does seem to be changing to more community-based transmission. So we mean here children passing on to children, or people who are infected originally through sexual contact, then passing on to family members and family members passing it to each other.
Right. One of the things that I do recall from the COVID pandemic was the sheer level of research capacity which we developed to look at the prevalence of different strains and then to look at transmissibility. The picture that all three of you are drawing is one where we actually aren't in the same scientific place. Is that broadly right, Lilith?
I would say so. However, there has been a lot of in-country, in DRC in particular, development that has happened partially due to COVID surveillance that has been mobilised in this outbreak. But yeah, very much the case. We're not at the same scale of research being done as there was during the COVID pandemic now.
Josie, do you agree?
Definitely. Mpox is one of those viruses that are relatively neglected when it comes to funding for research, as well as more the kind of public health surveillance. We did have the 2022 global pandemic, so there was an opportunity to improve that, and we haven't risen to that opportunity. So understanding the real key gaps in what's happening, particularly for clade 1A, which has been endemic in many countries on the African continent, we could be doing a lot more in the past, but this is now the moment. So we need to make sure that we're looking at those kind of studies that will help improve our understanding around transmission dynamics, which populations are at risk, how is it spreading between people, because all of that knowledge will help us then deploy where we use the interventions, whether it be better communication to at-risk populations or whether it be who's the most appropriate people for vaccines.
I suppose, Trudy, that thinking about variant stroke clades, one of the things that must worry you most is the idea of fairly rapid mutation within human-to-human transmission. In other words, the thing can replicate itself in new ways without actually having to be restricted to an animal contact with humans.
Absolutely. And I think it brings us back to the question you just asked, actually, and how we have come to know of this 1B outbreak, because Your question was about research in those regions, and it just happened that there was a team who were working on the animal reservoirs and looking at sampling the animals, and they were noticing that there was something unusual with these new cases in humans in the hospitals. But they came together because we had a meeting in Rwanda, which was around research capacity strengthening, and actually the team were working on cholera and had known each other from before, because I think it's quite a useful analogy to go back to the Ebola outbreak even, and the efforts that have happened from Ebola, Zika, of course COVID, but there is really long-standing collaborations between lots of groups, and especially on these really vulnerable border settings. And so I think a good news element to this is those teams were able to come together and mount the research response. And some of these unknowns we're waiting for now, that same team have the data and are analysing it literally as we speak.
Lilith, let's talk a bit about whether or not or how cases appear outside the Democratic Republic of Congo. Seems to be like the kind of place where a lot of this is most located. In what other countries have we seen confirmed cases?
Well, we're seeing confirmed cases of clade 1B in neighbouring countries. So they've been confirmed in Burundi and Uganda, and also some further north in Kenya, so neighbouring African countries. We've also seen recently a case confirmed in Thailand and one in Sweden. But when you have an outbreak that is this large in a localised area such as DRC, you are inevitably going to get those importations into different countries. That's going to happen as a certainty. It's what then happens after that that are the scenarios that we need to understand.
And let's be clear, we don't have more than isolated cases in most of these other places.
Outside of Africa, we do not. It's isolated cases at present. However, there is evidence of community transmission in some of the neighbouring African countries.
OK, and there's absolutely no reason to suppose that that wouldn't happen elsewhere. There's no physiological reason why it wouldn't.
There's no physiological reason. However, contact patterns can be different in different human populations as well. So it's worth noting that some of the areas that we're seeing a lot of the sexual transmission occurring in the eastern DRC are areas, that regions that are affected by conflict. There are also displaced people there, and they are mining regions that have economic migrants who are based there, and there are also sex workers in this area, as there are everywhere, of course. But this is a particular feature of the communities in which it's spreading.
Trudy Lang, is that how you see it?
I think one of the complexities, and there's been a lot of discussion around drawing on what we all learned in the early days of working on HIV, and this precise complex setting, as was just quite rightly said, where we've got a combination of trucking routes, sex worker trade, but also these highly vulnerable populations. And we are seeing a shift in transmission already from being very much around sexual transmission to more community-wide transmission. And especially as we've seen in Goma in the refugee camps, a high number of children being infected. And I think this is a really worrying shift. The other point to make is it's really difficult, as we've heard already, to do the lab confirmation of these cases. But it appears as they've all begun from this region where 1B appeared, and they're showing these same characteristics of this person-to-person transmission. We are assuming that many of these cases are 1B, which is quite worrying.
Lilith, I was wondering whether there was the problem identified with COVID, which is that the more people have it, the more possibility of mutations there are. And arising from that, there was also the question over COVID about whether or not mutations actually would get milder as they progress, because the virus would want to replicate itself and killing its host wasn't a great way of doing it.
The one thing that I would say is that we still have many, many questions that we need to answer about these current clades that are transmitting before we start thinking about the evolution. For example, we still are not fully clear on whether there are the differences, how much of the difference in how much these clades are spreading is inherent to the virus itself, or whether that is just a factor of the population it's spreading in. Like, what's the relative proportions of that? Also, severity. We do not know, as Trudy's mentioned, we don't know the full spectrum of severity and how that plays out in different human populations with different underlying vulnerabilities and different conditions. We haven't really characterised that for even one of the clades very well, let alone being able to compare across them. So there are many, many questions that we still need to answer about these currently transmitting clades.
Josie, what do you think about that question? Because it's rather a comforting thought that viruses need to get milder as they need to progress. And I suppose there's no such total rule.
I'll just go back to the difference between SARS-CoV-2, which is a virus that causes COVID, and Mpox. These are very different viruses, with SARS-CoV-2 being an RNA virus. And these viruses, like with influenza, are known to evolve quite rapidly and have changes. So for Mpox, this is a big, big, clunky virus. It's going to take a bit longer to have those changes. So I think, you know, in terms of speed, it's going to look very, very different to what we've seen before. I think that idea that a virus wants to, you know, preserve its host, its person, whatever the route it's managing to grow in, sounds very sound. But I think, you know, with SARS-CoV-2, it did evolve, and we are seeing changes in the virus, and it's looking like less severe. But overall, I'm not sure if all the evidence backs it up. The biggest risk here, though, is making sure that the vaccines that we have for Mpox remain true to what's circulating in the environment.
Okay, that's a very good point to move on. But I was, since we're talking about vaccines, I did just want to know, Trudy, whether or not other vaccines which are commonly used for pox viruses might have any kind of effect on delaying Mpox.
Well, it's one of the theories that's in place at the moment that potentially it might have been a factor in this, you know, upscaling of this outbreak, that smallpox's vaccine isn't given in this region anymore because they eradicated smallpox. And so potentially people who had the smallpox vaccine might be safer than those that, obviously, the younger population who haven't. And so it could be that even giving the smallpox vaccine might be useful. But as Josie said, we really need to test these vaccines in this clade 1B and in these regions with these complex co-infections that these people have got. But certainly it would be really great to understand if the smallpox vaccine does offer some protection.
Josie, more about vaccines. The suggestion, obviously, that you've made is that there is an Mpox vaccine, but that it's not necessarily been updated for new clades. Is that broadly right?
Yep, there are vaccines that are available. We have one in particular that's a commercial vaccine that can be purchased. And it's those studies. So we know it does show protection against Mpox. We've seen, you know, from the 2022 pandemic, but we need to do those studies now, as Trudy just mentioned, to ensure that they're effective against the current circulating ones, clade 1A and clade 1B. And we need to make sure that they work for all populations that are high risk. You know, we've talked about children, we've talked about people who maybe their immune system doesn't work so well. We refer to as immunocompromised, people living with HIV. So there's a few outstanding big research questions that we need to address to be able to really have the confidence in those vaccines. It doesn't stop us using those vaccines, though, with those populations, as long as they've been shown to be safe.
Right. Lilith, are those vaccines available in the places where the people are getting Mpox?
Not at present. This is a global challenge that we're, I think, are going to have to come together globally to address. And lots of public health agencies are working on this. WHO certainly are. Many other vaccine funders are. But there is not a vaccine program in place in DRC at present.
Trudy.
So this was one of the reasons it was announced as being a public health emergency of concern, to try and expedite this global collaborations to get these vaccines available in the region where we're seeing the outbreak. And so it would be really excellent to see these vaccines mobilised, and even the smallpox vaccine given widely in these communities, because really, if we're going to create global health security everywhere and prevent this disease from moving around the world, the best caution we can take globally is to get this under control in the region. And vaccines are always the way out if we have vaccines available.
Josie, many listeners will remember that there was an Mpox outbreak in 2022. And back then, countries in Europe acquired vaccines because they were worried about it. But it seems that while there are vaccines here, there may not be vaccines in Africa where they really are needed. Is that broadly right?
In 2022, there was the opportunity for those countries to purchase those vaccines. And so many countries, particularly high-income countries, have the stockpile of certain vaccines. The challenge now really is identifying those countries that have the stockpile and facilitating with them, like through the role of WHO, to donate those vaccines to the relevant countries on the African continent who need it now. So that's one of the steps. The other part is around how many doses are actually available to purchase. So I would say, getting orders in so that the companies know that they can produce more and that there's going to be buyers for that. So that's the other kind of strand that we need to think about. And that does take time to make these vaccines. And then there is, of course, beyond just having vaccines, you need to be able to have them approved within the countries so that they can use them. So that's something WHO have been working on, like to give kind of emergency licensing to these vaccines within countries. So that's the countries affected need to work with their suppliers. I think that's all important. So the vaccines aren't where they need to be at the moment, but we shouldn't just stop at getting the vaccines in country. Countries need support to be able to then deploy those vaccines and have the structures in place. And we saw a lot of learnings through COVID, particularly where this really slowed down getting doses into arms. We just need to make sure we support those countries so that they get the vaccine, but they also have the structure to vaccinate people.
Lilith, the point being made there essentially is we've been through something like this before. We had to get vaccines out to a lot of other countries and so on. So we have created structures which are appropriate to do that. Is it your impression that we are up to speed? In other words, we're going as quickly as we can on this, or I think you're shaking your head at me.
Well, I'm not involved in any of the vaccine availability or supply chain issues at all. I know that my hope is that we could get there quicker than we are doing. And I think one of the greatest lessons that we learned from COVID, or learned what hopefully not to do again, was that global equity and vaccine availability was one of the key lessons we ought to have learned from that. So it would be really fantastic if we could come together as a global community and achieve that this time.
Josie, I don't want to be a scaremongering programme, but what's the worst case scenario here?
I guess, you know, someone who works on this area for some time is a lack of action. So we've, you know, had this outbreak of something that's quite different, clade 1B, for some time, for some months. And now there's been a global announcement that this is really, this should be taken seriously by all countries, and they have responsibilities to play. So what we need to see is action from those countries. So those countries really impacted need the support, both financial support, the logistics support. And I think if we don't see that happening soon, then that is another failure of kind of preparing for these eventualities. So we should always be learning for this, and we have to see countries step up.
Trudy, I don't, it seems wrong of me to press on this, but I think I have to. If we don't get that cooperation and we don't learn those lessons, what is the downside?
Well, I think this is what has been coming up time and time again. You know, my work is with the scientific teams on those border countries. So I'm working with teams in DRC, Rwanda and Burundi, and trying to really learn all we can at the moment. I'm in touch with them every day and seeing these cases that they're dealing with. And I've been up to the border myself, and I've worked in these settings for nearly 30 years. These are really vulnerable communities in impoverished places, and they're really difficult to work in. And as Josie said, the risk is they go ignored. And I've been asked several times, is this something that worries you, or what's the worst outcome? The worst outcome's happening right now in those communities. You know, there's children catching this awful infection and a devastating impact on these communities. And I think, as Josie said, the worst risk is this is ignored, and it's allowed to run in these very vulnerable settings. I think another important point to make about the right now piece is when this first emerged earlier this year, when I was out there in January, it was the middle of the rainy season, and you know, there were none of the roads operating properly. It took hours and hours to get anywhere, and that impacts everything, trucks moving, people moving. Right now, this is the dry season, and people are on the long holidays and people are moving around, and that's one of the driving factors for the increasing cases we're seeing. And so mobilising the action now, the WHO have called for this, is really important.
Trudy Lang there with Josie Golding and Lilith Whittles. My thanks to them and to Jonas Albanaz. And my conclusion from all that is keep researching and get the vaccines to the people who need it. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirstine Knight and Drew Heinemann. The editor was Richard Varden, and the sound engineers were Jonathan Glover and James Beard. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
From BBC Radio 4, 11 Minutes Dead, a paranormal thriller about near-death experience.
once believed death occurred at the exact moment the heart stopped beating.
Sammy, where are you going?
We now know this is not true.
You don't deserve a daughter, so I will come and take her away.
Listen to 11 Minutes Dead, available now on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.